It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Russia's defense ministry says it is implementing a daily humanitarian pause in military operations around the besieged Syrian city of Aleppo. Humanitarian chief from the United Nations says what is really needed is a 48-hour ceasefire. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales tells VOA he believes the UN proposal of 48 hours is more realistic if humanitarian concerns are really paramount.
It seems to me that it must fit into some sort of response to difficulties that the Syrians and the Russians have been having around Aleppo over the last couple of days, where the siege, the blockade has been broken. And at the same time, the government-controlled area of Aleppo is in itself risking being isolated. And so I think they're probably trying somehow or other to slow down rebel advances, to give the Assad government time to get forces into position, etc.
Reuters reports some government and diplomatic sources are saying with the insurgent threat to take the battle to Syrian government's western districts increases prospects for a more protracted and bloody battle. Russia's UN envoy Vitaly Churkin says the use of Crimea's annexation, the issue there will never be revisited, he says. Russia has accused Ukraine of plotting attacks in the disputed peninsula. Churkin called the alleged plots a clear act of sabotage and terrorism. Also in the news, local news media in Nigeria reporting two new cases of polio in what would have been the country's two-year anniversary of being polio-free. Nigeria's health minister says it is a setback. This is VOA News. Series of blasts in Thailand's southern provinces in a 24-hour period between yesterday and today has killed at least three people, wounded dozens more. The Thai junta chief said the bombs are an attempt to create chaos and confusion. In a reference last week, a referendum, millions of Thais voted to approve a junta-backed constitution. The country's military leader says opens the way to new elections, but critics see it as legitimizing the military's role in the government for years to come. Turning to U.S. politics, for the second time this week, a group of prominent Republicans says it will not be supporting Donald Trump for president. Meantime, Trump has called President Obama the founder of the Islamic State, and he told a group of evangelical Christians in Orlando, Florida, the U.S. is not well-liked around the world.
But they don't respect us. They don't respect our country. They don't respect our president. They don't like our president. Putin doesn't like our president. Putin has no respect for Obama whatsoever. Wouldn't it be nice if we could actually get along with Russia? Wouldn't that be a decent thing? Wouldn't that be nice?
Meantime, Clinton campaigned in Warren, Michigan, where she formally unveiled her economic plans.
My message to every worker in Michigan and across America is this. I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Trump also is opposed to the so-called TPP, that Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Turning now to the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, American gymnast Simone Biles is now officially the best gymnast in the world. She won a gold medal late Thursday. VOA's Mark Brewer was there.
Simone Biles showed why she was the heavy favorite, putting on a spectacular floor exercise that closed the competition, as well as scoring the most points of anyone in any of the four routines. The 19-year-old Biles was overcome with emotion when she learned she was Olympic champion.
Everything hit me at once, and I realized I had finally done it.
Biles' combined score for the uneven bars, vault, balance beam, and floor was 2.1 points ahead of teammate and one of her best friends, Ali Raisman, who got the silver medal. Alia Mustafina of Russia won the bronze. Park Brewer, VOA News, at the Rio Olympics.
And U.S. swimmer Michael Phelps earned his 22nd career gold medal in the 200-meter individually medal. A medley, that is. That happened Thursday night. American swimmer Simone Manuel tied for gold in the 100-meter freestyle, sharing that title with Penelope Olsiak of Canada. Manuel is the first African-American to win in a women's singles event. Get more on the Olympics at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington, filling in for James Batty, who is on vacation until next Tuesday. Today is Friday, August 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia police spokesman Ray Hamonga refutes report that some foreigners were caught trying to cast ballot in Thursday's polls.
But as far as we are concerned, our records are showing no report of any foreigner having been arrested or attempting to vote in Zambia.
Research epidemiologist Judy Omumbo talks about scientific cooperation in determining climate conditions and disease.
A big part of our work is to try and build the awareness about the power of information. How by sharing information, you don't actually lose. It is, again, a benefit to society. And to be able to be part of developing that benefit is important.
Also today, across Southern Africa, liberation movements struggle to keep power. The Rockefeller Foundation helps East African farmers market their crops, and a new penal code raises controversy in Cameroon. The Zambian police have sharply denied local media reports suggesting that some foreign nationals have been arrested for voting in Thursday's general election and referendum. Ray Hamonga is a spokesperson for the Zambian police. He also told VOA that overall, voting was peaceful in spite of a few isolated cases of violence. The police were primarily in charge of providing security required for the entire electoral process, including the protection of voter materials used for the elections and referendum. Hamonga told me that officers deployed at all polling stations across the country were well trained to ensure that voters exercised their constitutional right without fear or intimidation from opposing party supporters.
Okay, as regards to police officers conducting themselves during this election, we know that police officers are there to provide the necessary security that is required for the whole election process. And we have just had the briefing this afternoon, about 17 hours, where the director of the Electoral Commission has actually commended the Zambia police for the good job and the security that they provided for the whole electoral process as of now. Now, of course, even after this, we not necessary to blow our own transit. We put everything possible within our legal means to ensure that the whole electoral process is not interrupted and necessarily from any distractors. So far, as police, we are also impressed with the conduct of our officers, and we are remaining with you to ensure that we reach the end of the whole process and even beyond of the process, because you know that Zambia police is mandated to maintain law and order. So even after elections, just as it was before, during, and even after elections, we will continue maintaining law and order in this country.
In your assessment and the reports that you've gotten so far, how did the people comport themselves during the voting process?
Generally, they were very peaceful. We owe it to the Zambian people for being peaceful. We have also been known the peaceful nation. Of course, except there are some few incidents where maybe there could have been one or two things happening, but generally speaking, the elections have been very peaceful. And we actually want to urge the Zambian people to continue being peaceful. And our police should also continue to maintain law and order for this nation still retains its title of being a very peaceful and peaceful people in Southern Africa.
Ray, we heard reports, local media reports, that there were some foreign nationals who the police have arrested for attempting to vote during Thursday's election. What can you tell me about this?
As far as we are concerned, as police, there's a report. However, our doors are always open. If anybody has that information, we can bring forward the police. The matter will be investigated. We get to the bottom of that issue if that thing is already happened. But as far as we are concerned, our records are showing no report of any foreigner having been arrested or attempting to vote in Zambia.
Some people are expressing concern that possible tension could be created or violence could erupt when the results start trickling in. Are the police ready to maintain law and order as the election results trickle in?
As Zambians, we are a country of laws. And if anybody has any grievances and how to make the process, there are laws that need to be followed. Violence is not one of them. Anybody who wants to advocate for violence, to express his views, will be made head on by Zambia police.
What will be your message to the people of Zambia as they await the release of the final result of these elections?
We want to appeal to them. Zambia is for Zambians, and the only one country is Zambia. And as such, shall we maintain the peace that we are enjoying? We don't have any other country that we can go to in case it falls into trouble. So we want to appeal to Zambia that let's maintain the peace, and that's a peace to deal with individuals. The police just have to supplement the peace in this country.
Ray Hamonga is the spokesperson for the Zambian police. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The sun may be setting on the almighty ruling parties of Southern Africa, including liberation parties like South Africa's African National Congress and Zimbabwe's ZANU-PF. From Johannesburg, Anita Power analyzes politics in the region as Zambia voted Thursday.
It is a familiar tale in Southern Africa. The revered liberation movement turned ruling party, led by struggle heroes of decades past, is facing increasing criticism and challenges over enduring poverty, unemployment, and alleged corruption. In Zimbabwe, the venerable ZANU-PF, hailed for fighting British rule more than three decades ago, is the target of unprecedented protests. Protesters are led by war veterans who say 92-year-old President Robert Mugabe, the only leader independent Zimbabwe has ever had, is a dictator. A similar tale resounds in Angola, where the People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola has run the country since 1975. Government forces have cracked down on dissenters, rights groups say, and last week shot dead a teenage boy at a peaceful protest in the capital. The Mozambique Liberation Front, Frelimo, is still struggling to find peace with its opposition, more than two decades after the end of the civil war. And in South Africa, the African National Congress last week suffered an election victory that many onlookers framed as an embarrassing defeat. The ANC won the greatest number of seats in the local elections, but it lost an unprecedented amount of support to the opposition. The Democratic Alliance bested the ANC in several major metropolitan areas, which could portend further ANC losses in national polls in 2019. The head of the Africa program at London research institution Chatham House, Alex Vines, says the reason for this trend is simple. Young voters are growing in number, and many do not remember the pain of colonialism and oppression, but they keenly feel the pain of unemployment and inequality.
Most of these liberation movements have lost touch with people. They have been unable to provide jobs and opportunities and spread wealth. And so inequality has grown. A number of party apparatchiks have got very rich.
That is the case in Zambia, its former acting president told VOA News on the eve of Thursday's vote. Guy Scott says the ruling Patriotic Front under President Edgar Lungu has been criticized for corruption and mismanagement and blamed for the nation's economic woes as the landlocked nation struggles with drought and hunger. Lungu now faces a major opposition challenge, and with it, the prospect of violence and allegations of rigging. But analyst Victor Shali says upheaval at the polls is not necessarily a bad thing. He says strong opposition can motivate the ruling party to work harder. That, he says, may be painful for the powerful ruling parties, but ultimately is good for democracy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The parliament in Cameroon has adopted a revision of the country's penal code. After popular outcry, lawmakers deleted a highly controversial provision granting ministers the immunity from prosecution. But it is still not a very popular document. Part of the code now criminalizes adultery and citizens' inability to pay rent. Lawyers in the English-speaking parts of the country took to the streets in June to protest these and other issues in the code. Harmony Boga is the president of the Northwest Lawyers Association, one of the groups that protested from the regional capital, Bamenda. He explained to reporter Eugene Infongwa that, in his view, some issues now included in the penal code should have been left as matters for civil law.
If you look at the international conventions, they are replete with provisions that actually say that family is the most fundamental unit of society. And that is the reason why marriage is considered to be the most sacred of contracts in the classification of contracts. If you find a situation where the penal code oversimplifies the creation of reasons for divorce, you realize that it is a strategy to fragilize the society, pit husband and wife against one another. This is one of the dangers of criminalizing the relationship in matrimony by facilitating the ease of introducing adultery, which in ordinary civil litigation is a ground of divorce. I am not saying I'm advocating for a lowering of the moral standards that is expected of men and women in matrimony. I am saying that when once people have been married, we should seek to protect the marriage. That is why in the civil process, there is provision for conciliation before the matter can be taken to court. Even by the judge, it is prescribed, it is mandatory. And if you don't do it before you go to open court to hear the matter, it can vitiate the proceedings. This is not one of the things that is envisaged in this penal law.
Now, you did mention contradictions. So one of the main contradictions was the fight against corruption and the fact that we saw in this new code a provision to give ministers immunity from prosecution.
Yeah. The introduction of immunity for ministers, even if it has been withdrawn, it was so bad-intentioned, it was so illegal that it contradicted the constitutional provision that all of us must be equal before the law. And what motivates a government to insulate its ministers from prosecution? It's simple. They constitute the corruption germ, and they are conscious of it, and we're going the extra mile to protect themselves. If you link this up with the requirement of declaration of assets of public servants from the level of directors or so upwards to the president, none of them, since that provision was put in the Constitution, has declared their assets, none. And the fear must have been that if we don't create immunity, they can invoke a constitutional provision someday and harass you, whether when you're in office or after you have left office. Even now that there are the pretensions of having removed them, we don't have an independent judiciary, whether in the public prosecutor's office, that's the legal department, or the bench. A few people here and there may be assertive, but when they do, they get clobbered out of the line. My point is, even the removal of this immunity, so-called, hasn't changed anything. You cannot sue these people without players. You need a fiat.
That was lawyer Harmony Boga of the Northwest Lawyers Association in Cameroon. He was speaking with reporter Eugene Infongwa. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Food loss and waste is an urgent global crisis, according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO. One-third of all the food produced in the world every year, some 1.3 billion tons, get lost or wasted. Some say this is enough to feed the world's 1.2 billion hungry, undernourished people. But in an effort to find a lasting solution to the global crisis, the Rockefeller Foundation has unveiled a $130 million initiative known as YieldWise. It aims to reduce post-harvest loss in developing countries and consumer and retail food waste in developed economies. From the Tanzanian town of Iringa, Ruben Chiama reports.
Officials say the initiative aims at putting proven simple technologies in the hands of smallholder farmers in Africa while creating new paths to market for their crops. John Scovere is the team leader of YieldWise Mains project in Tanzania, being implemented by the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA. He says the scheme seeks to increase local farmers' income by cutting maize post-harvest losses in half.
We are working in the northern regions, central regions, and southern regions of Tanzania. We started with studies to establish the real causes of post-harvest losses. We then went on to test storage technologies. Then we began a pilot phase to link farmers to off-takers, the big buyers. We are shortening the chain that farmers have to engage when they are selling their maize. The second thing that we are doing is aggregation, collective selling by farmers, selling together to a single buyer using a forward delivery contract.
The Zimbabwean-born official says the project, which kicked off in October 2014, has proven successful. It's delivering higher incomes to farmers, better health for the community, and a sustainable food and environmental future for the East African nation. Tanzania loses about up to a third of maize production annually, or 1 million tons, due to post-harvest losses, representing 4% of the agricultural gross domestic product, GDP. Alan Gakonda is a senior official of the Rural Urban Development Initiative, RUDI, one of the local partners involved in the multi-million dollar project. He says there is need to lobby for government support in order to enhance post-harvest management and technology use.
Tabu iliyopo ni kwamba zinauzwa bei kubwa ni kwa sababu zinatozwa VAT ya 18%. Maana yake kama mfuko unauzwa shilingi 5000, 18% yake ni kodi.
He says there are some complaints from farmers that these airtight bags are still expensive. This is because the technologies attract value-added taxes, or a type of consumption tax placed on a product whenever value is added at a stage of production and at final sale. Therefore, I would like to urge the government to step in and unlock the impasse so that farmers can benefit fully from these technologies and help them reduce the losses. Emelita Singaile is the chairperson of the Iringa-based Mangalali Farmers Association. She says the YieldWise program has enabled maize farmers to store grains safely at the household and community levels.
Kikundi hiki kimeweza kuwanufaisha wakulima hawa kwa kuweza kuhifadhi mazao bila madawa kwenye kukuni na pia kuhifadhi kwenye mifuko ya pixi majumbani mwao.
She says our group has benefited from the initiative. We are now able to store our grains in these environment-friendly bags without applying chemicals. Initially, we would lose our grains after harvesting to the pests. Now we are able to store our maize up to even 2 years. The 52-year-old mother of five says maize harvest from our 2-hectare piece of land has doubled thanks to the YieldWise project. Apart from the maize project in Tanzania, the Rockefeller Foundation is also working in Kenya with Coca-Cola, supporting mango farmers to quickly sell their fruits to a guaranteed buyer. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Iringa, Tanzania.
The African continent is dotted with weather stations busy collecting data on rainfall, temperature, wind conditions, and so forth. When this meteorological information is widely shared, it helps government policymakers and health professionals predict, prevent, or mitigate weather-influenced diseases such as malaria, meningitis, and plague. The problem is, this critical data is not being widely shared in Africa, mainly because of the prohibitive cost of acquiring and sharing it. But as VOA's Adam Phillip reports, scientists at Columbia University and elsewhere are hoping to change that.
Across Africa, it's easy to see the direct connection between climate conditions and disease. In humid parts of the continent, more rainfall creates conditions where malarial mosquitoes can live longer and infect more people. In Africa's semi-arid Sahel region, the hot, dusty, dry season makes people more susceptible to epidemic meningitis. Finding ways to share information that connect climate and health data is one mission of Columbia University's International Research Institute for Climate and Society, or IRI. It's not an easy task. IRI climatologist Bradford Lyon explains that in Kenya, for example, where some 1,500 weather stations collect detailed data, fewer than 50 make their measurements publicly available. This forces scientists to rely on global satellite data, which produce less accurate models for local climates.
It's actually a challenge to do that. I mean, there's different types of data sets we can view as climate scientists, like that which is remotely sensed from satellites. There are certain data analyses that are put together that sort of interpolate between stations what's going on, but that's not very useful information at a specific location, which is critical.
Global or even continental climate data may be of interest in the abstract, but people need to know about local climate trends to prevent disease. Research epidemiologist Judy Omumbo is the Associate Director of Public Health at ICF International, based in Kenya. She says the most effective way to know what the climate is doing overall is to have daily records concerning rainfall, humidity, winds, and other weather parameters over decades. Those measurements can then be correlated with local health records to plot overall trends.
But because there are financial constraints, these often don't get collated and put together into a central database. Now, with the passage of time, there is a very high likelihood that this information will get lost. So if you want to have the information, you've got to pay for it. And at the moment, the going rate is, this is something like $2 per parameter per day. So if you're looking at picking up daily information or hourly information, it really adds up and becomes very expensive.
Omumbo has had personal experience with these difficulties. For example, she and her colleagues at IRI learned that a tea plantation in the Kenyan highlands had been taking daily weather readings every day for over 50 years, but it wanted to charge a high fee for releasing the data. But Omumbo learned that Kenya's National Weather Service also had the data. Her team asked officials there to provide the data free of charge in the spirit of scientific collaboration for the common good. Eventually, they did, and Omumbo was able to use the data to confirm that temperatures in western Kenya have been rising.
So a big part of our work is to try and build the awareness about the power of information. How by sharing information, you don't actually lose. It is, again, a benefit to society. And to be able to be part of developing that benefit is important. Development is empowering people to be able to do for themselves.
Judy Omumbo is a research epidemiologist and the Associate Director of Public Health at ICF International, based in Kenya. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Before we leave you, let's take a look one more time at some African news headlines. A Niger Delta youth leader has told rioters that militants have blown up pipeline carrying crude oil. On Wednesday, a group called Delta Greenland Justice Mandate said it had attacked a pipeline belonging to state oil firm NNPC and local firm Shoreline Natural Resources in Orobo in Delta State. Youth leader Collins Edema told rioters that the pipeline was on fire and that protesters were continuing a protest that began Tuesday demanding jobs and housing. Reuters has not yet been able to independently confirm Edema's account. In other Nigerian news, local news media are reporting two new cases of polio on what would have been the country's two-year anniversary of being polio-free. Nigeria's Leadership newspaper reported Thursday that Nigeria's Minister of Health said a team is being sent to immunize children in Borno State, where the outbreaks have been reported. The Leadership newspaper says the health minister, Professor Isaac Adewale, called the development a setback, but assured the nation the government will do everything possible to be on top of the situation. The cases reportedly occurred in a state in Nigeria's north, where the insurgent group Boko Haram has been active. Last month, Doctors Without Borders issued a statement calling the health situation in Borno State critical, with at least 500,000 people in urgent need of drinking water, food, medical care, and shelter. The group called for a massive relief operation as the Nigerian army retook control of the main towns and villages, some of which had been under Boko Haram's sway for 2 years. That's it for this Friday edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again next week for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, managing editor William Eagle, I'm Peter Clotte in Washington. Wish you all have a peaceful Friday.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
All day, all night.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plant be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.